Okay, welcome to the AST Transplant in 10 discussion. My name's Cameron Wolf. I'm an infectious disease physician in the transplant division at Duke University in North Carolina. My job today is to talk about donors who you know are infected and whether or not they're safe to accept. And I think before going into a sort of a microbiology textbook worth of different pathogens, which I'm not sure is ideally helpful, what I really wanted to talk about was maybe an algorithm that I sometimes use when we get these questions to try and help you decipher really which organs may be safe and which donors you may need to decline. And so I want to start actually by thinking about the sort of four questions that I most commonly ask my colleagues and sort of review on donor history when this comes up. And the first is actually, do we formally have an identification from the micro lab of what the infection is that we're talking about? Or in fact, is this still a syndrome? Oftentimes, folks would be aware that we may know full well what the organ-specific condition is going on, but we've not actually been able to formally identify it yet. Or we may even know the type of bacteria or type of virus, but still be lacking details such as sensitivity profile. The second question that I think is then predicated on the first is really, what do we know about the treatment for that, and is that safe? And in particular, is that something that could be given to a donor before organ transplantation, or is it something that's safe even to use in a recipient once transplants occurred? The third question is that infection by its very nature systemic, for example, a bloodstream infection or most viral infections, or is it something that's very organ-specific or tissue-specific, which obviously makes a difference when you think about who your recipient's going to be and which organ you're talking about. And then the final question, which I think is maybe the hardest one, is what's unique about that infection in the context of immunosuppression? And even if you know how it's presenting in the donor that you're weighing up, how's that going to be different when you place immunosuppression on your recipient? At the end of the day, all of these four probably matter less than the question of who is the recipient that you're offering this to and how urgent are they in a position of needing transplant. Certainly, for example, understanding the risk for a kidney transplant recipient who's quite happily sitting on dialysis in a non-urgent clinical situation, that's a different risk framework than, for example, someone who needs a much more urgent heart or lung transplant and has a morbidity from saying no. And ultimately, that sort of weighed up decision, I think, is really important. So once you go through this first sort of algorithm, I think the second thing that then becomes equally quite important is to then sort of weigh up almost which kingdoms, in some sense, do you think your infection that you're dealing with comes from, and can you be in any way more specific? And I like to think of these as sort of four broad categories: bacterial processes, which we'll go into in a minute, viral pathogens, which I like to sort of split down into three kinds, the seasonal respiratory viruses that typically will circulate and cause challenges around the Christmas time in North America, latent viruses, so we're talking about the herpes viruses, CMV, EBV, HSV, and some others, and then vector-borne viruses such as West Nile, Zika, dengue, these sorts of things. And I think they really need to be addressed separately. Fungal pathogens are their own separate category. And then for convenience, I tend to lump everything else into another category, and that includes mycobacteria, so particularly TB, and any of the parasitic infections we'll go into in a little minute. So I want to start actually by looking at some of the bacterial processes more specifically. And so when we think about bacteria, at least within the United States, we have a very clear algorithm, as you'd know, as to which samples organ procurement agencies are mandated to test for us and which ones we can additionally ask as recipient centers to be taken or, in fact, may be available for you. And so the first are obviously sputum samples. Sputum samples, to me, I think really, you know, if you're dealing with the possible lung recipient, I think is overwhelmingly the most impactful. We know in that setting there's an increased risk of anastomotic problems when joining airways. We know there's a pleural spillage risk that occurs. And so at least in my center and my own practice is that if I have a positive sputum culture, I'm typically going to want to have my lung recipient on 10 to 14 days worth of appropriate coverage for that organism once I have sensitivities back, really to make sure that that's appropriately covered and the anastomosis of the airway is starting to heal. I think the sputum impact for other organ systems is really very small. There's some debate about whether it impacts thoracic organ recipients, but really outside of the lungs, it's just much less of an issue. Similarly, urine, you can really stratify. I think really the overwhelming concerns for urine is isolated to your kidney recipient. Again, in the fresh perioperative phase, you oftentimes have ureteral stents that can get chronically colonized. You can have fresh anastomotic problems. And understanding what your urine microbiome and your donor is going to be important because, again, I think you're looking typically at 10 to 14 days worth of antibiotics. For the most part, both of these transplanted donors will be safe, with the challenging exception perhaps of multidrug-resistant isolates, which you sometimes, unfortunately, don't find out until post-transplant. Blood cultures, I think, are a little bit different because by their very nature, they are systemic and will therefore be impactful upon all organ recipients. But I think the difference here with blood cultures is that it's important for us to understand there's differences in both pathogenicity according to the type of bacteria and also differences in terms of the amount of bacteria that's shed. So to play an example out, the donor who may have 1 out of 5 Coag-negative staph bacteremias, I really pay very little attention to. I may treat the recipient briefly, if at all. Compare that, for example, to the donor who may have had 4 or 5 days of persistent staph aureus bacteremia or persistent pseudomonal bacteremia, where they have in many studies been shown to portend a really meaningful risk to their recipients and do warrant treatment. I typically approach those as saying that bacteremia in the donor is the same as if I would put the bacteremia in the recipient, and I'll typically treat them for at least 2 weeks again. Sometimes you have information that's organ-specific or tissue-specific and may not be part of the natural procurement organization cultures for us. And the three ones that I think are worth highlighting here is, firstly, meningitis. There are actually now some data to suggest that donors who die of a recognized cause of bacterial meningitis, particularly those where you know the donor has been on an appropriate treatment for at least 24 to 48 hours, they can actually be safely used. There's a little bit of sort of buyer beware, I think, in these circumstances, and it would sort of certainly we like to place all of our recipients of these organs also on appropriate antibiotics with the recognition that occasionally these also represent bacteremia, not just meningitis. Infective endocarditis, again, sort of the nearest equivalent to a bacterial bloodstream infection that you're going to have. These organs can be safely used, but again, I think you have to assume that there's going to be a higher bacterial burden in these patients. And similarly, you really do want to make sure, ideally, that the donor has had some pretreatment before you come into transplant. There are plenty of case series now where these donors have been used quite safely. Something that's a little bit more challenging to try and interpret, though, is, for example, traumatic injury donors where the abdomen may be laid open as part of the terminal illness for that donor. That clearly puts an external exposure risk on, for example, the abdominal organs. And there are cases before that have been well documented of, for example, abdominal bacteria, typical enteric bacteria, for example, causing problems with kidneys and liver transplants where the donor was left open. Sometimes it's also what's happening not just in the donor, but what's happening between the donor and when the organs come to you. And so I would challenge people to recognize that perfusate contamination cultures have been a problem in the United States over the last couple of years, and these can impact multiple organ systems. We would view these as being at least moderate potential to transmit, and there are occasional circumstances where, again, anastomotic problems can occur, but you can usually treat through them. Similarly, also worth keeping in the back of your mind, what's the environmental what are the environmental organisms that your donor and or recipient may be exposed to as part of the transplant process? And so, for example, if your transplant hospital happens to be one in an area of high multi-drug resistance, occasionally we can get this coming along, even though it may not have been a part of necessarily the donor illness. If you're involved in VCA transplants, I think this is its own unique sort of world. For face transplants, for example, the bacterial load in the sinuses are often very important as they're frequently transmitted intentionally with the patient as part of the reconstruction. And then urogynecological VCA transplants are their own very unique flora that are capable of being transplanted in penile and uterine transplants. But these are uncommon, so I'll move on. Viral diseases that are recognized in donors, I think, can be split up, firstly, as I said, into seasonal viruses, and I want to sort of talk about these separately. Increasingly, you may well be aware that donors have been tested at their hospital with multiplex PCR panels in the United States, which can range from as simple as influenza and RSV all the way through to multiplex panels where 10 to 15 different viruses are identified. And I think you can risk stratify these both in terms of virus, in terms of the organ for which you're going to procure, and then also the length of time that that virus may or may not have been present. So to me, influenza, for a start, is certainly most clearly an issue for lung transplants, although there are some case data of people who get the most critically unwell due to influenza also having cardiomyopathies, and understanding how that plays out for your donor would be important. Adenovirus, equally, I think something that has a potential to disseminate both perhaps subclinically in donors, but certainly in the immunosuppressed recipients. And so this is not only a problem for me in lung transplants, but also particularly within livers where hepatitis from adenovirus is well recognized, as well as intestine transplants, where it can be quite a complicated process to interpret and is worse with immunosuppression. So to me, influenza, particularly in the acute phase, is a high-risk condition where I'd like my patients, particularly lung recipients, to at least have had a certain number of days of a neuraminidase inhibitor drug under their skin before we would consider them. Many centers would say that for a lung transplant recipient, that would be a non-starter. Adenovirus, I also think, can pose us some real significant issues, perhaps stratified mostly in the livers and kidneys, livers, intestines, and lungs, less so perhaps for hearts. RSV and parainfluenza are both challenging viruses for the lung recipients, and so we've had scenarios where both donor-derived RSV or parainfluenza infection have caused really significant morbidity, as well as early post-transplant iatrogenic RSV and parainfluenza, leading, I think, most people to be very cautious about using these in lung transplants. They don't seem to have the same issue elsewhere. And then really, I think, you know, human metapneumovirus is something we're still learning about, perhaps a relevant issue in the lung, and I say perhaps because I'm unaware of data to support its worse mortality. And I think really if you get to rhinovirus or in fact anything else on this list that may pop up on your center-specific PCR that I've not talked about, I actually think the risk is really low and these donors can be safely used. So I would put a 1+ risk for RSV and human and parainfluenza. They should certainly at least be offered to centers. Depends on how sick your recipient is as to maybe whether you'd want to take them. And to me, there's almost vanishingly low risk from any of the rest of these recipients. Okay, so let's look at our second group of viruses. And I'll cover these really briefly because I think the risk is largely understood. So latent viruses, and when I talk about that, I'm talking about CMV, EBV, and other herpes viruses. And to me, I don't really see a scenario where an EBV mismatch, even in the worst scenario, ought to lead to an organ turndown. I think in an era where we understand a little bit about the risk that EBV mismatching occurs, that portends, but more particularly in an era where organ shortage is a major issue, to me these are almost never reasons to turn down. Similarly, CMV mismatches where you may have a donor that's positive and a recipient that's negative, we're now fortuitously in an era where there's lots of good preventative or preemptive strategies that are highly effective. Again, hard-pressed to imagine a scenario where that would be a reason to say no. Maybe intestines. Probably the biggest issue would be a uterine transplant where the outcome is fertility, in which case a CMV mismatch may actually portend a worse problem. So to move on to viruses really quickly that would occur from vectors, you know, one of the main ones that we've always been concerned with is West Nile virus. So West Nile is the big difference because it's usually asymptomatic in a recipient and is frequently devastatingly symptomatic in a transmitted donor. And so the big thing with West Nile is it's challenging to understand who would have been tested. Frequently, donors are not tested. That said, if you knew you had a history of someone who had recent West Nile, to me that would be an absolute non-starter for transplant. The hard part is to say how long away from West Nile is long enough for a donor to be suitable. We know that there's NAT positivity, so viremia in West Nile virus, for at least up to a couple of weeks. So, you know, I think if you were conservative, you'd probably want to have at least perhaps a month would be my practice. Along similar lines, Zika virus was very topical for us a couple of years ago. It's been less common in mainland United States recently, but still is endemic in many countries south of our border, and so maybe brought in with traveling donors. Again, acute infection with Zika to me would, even though we've not seen more severe disease in transplant, unlike West Nile virus, if you know your patient is viremic, that probably is a reason to say no. A distant history of Zika, I think, very much depends on the urgency of your transplant and for whom you're transplanting. So again, a uterine transplant where the outcome is fertility, a recent history of Zika anywhere in the last year, to be honest, I think should be a non-starter, but certainly 6 months. Other organ systems, you could probably be much more forgiving if it was an urgent transplant. Dengue, chikungunya, other viruses that can be arboviral spread, we know less about. Generally speaking, they don't have bad transplant outcomes, and you could cautiously move forward if it was in the past history for someone. I'm going to swap course one more time now and talk about fungal infections. Most commonly, our fungal infections that we transmit, of course, are Candida. Candidemia being the top of the risk list for that, and we've certainly seen lots of scenarios where candidemic donors can lead to mycotic aneurysmal changes in their recipients, so appropriate coverage of Candida is important. The ones that may be more unfamiliar to you, though, I think are the endemic mycoses and crypto. So certainly we've seen multiple clusters of cryptococcal transmissions in donors who were inadvertently found to be positive or known positive. And I think if you have someone who you recognize as cryptococcemic or cryptococcal meningitis as a donor, you should probably say no. A past history of cryptococcal disease, though treated appropriately, actually could be safe depending on the timeline. Of the endemic mycoses, really the major risk, I think, comes for coccidioides. So this is regionally found in the southeast of the United States, West Texas, Nevada, New Mexico, parts of California, and certainly south of the border. And the challenge with coccidioides is that it has a dormant latent phase that, in fact, can lead to stool transmissions many years down the road. And so understanding where your donor has geographically come from can be an important role to then play a prophylactic strategy, for example, with fluconazole, which is common in the regional southwest. Histoplasma and blastomycoses, actually far less commonly transmitted unless someone's acutely unwell and usually don't pose us problems. So to end with, I want to talk about some of the more unusual pathogens that would fit to me into the other category. And I'm going to start with TB. You know, the real challenge for TB and transplant is that, unfortunately, for deceased donors at least, we have very poor testing to understand latent infection. So PPDs or quantiferons are really not validated in the terminal illness phase and, in fact, give you inaccurate results. So the most significant parts that you can get out of a history is a past history of TB and its treatment, or most importantly, where that person has geographically been born, raised, and spent their life. And if you're in the United States and have never left the United States, Australasia or Western Europe, actually your chance of TB is really low. If you're someone who's accepting a donor who may not seem to have active TB but is born overseas or spent a significant period of time, then a very careful assessment of your post-transplant pathology, I think, is one of the best guides to say, does this person need latent therapy in the recipient? The other list here really includes the parasites. And so I briefly want to discuss toxo, strongyloides, and Chagas disease. So there have been recent changes in the United States, such that you now all know your toxo serology. And I, to be very clear, think there is no scenario, again, maybe outside of uterine VCA transplants, where the toxo serology should make a difference as to your choice of the donor. To me, these are all safe and can be all managed with appropriate recipient strategies. Greatest risk overwhelmingly in hearts, where therefore the use of trimethoprim sulfur should be the goal-directed effort, or at least the use of etobicoin in someone who can't generally take Bactrim. Other organ systems probably have some risk, although it's meaningfully less. But again, you'd rather know and go into it with eyes open. Strongyloides, again, not a reason not to take a donor, but a very good reason to want to offer prophylaxis, given that the prophylactic strategy with ivermectin is safe, cheap, and easy to use compared to a potentially devastating outcome that is really hard to treat if someone disseminates strongyloides. Chagas disease is probably the one that we know the least about. Not an issue that we know of to a great extent for folks born and raised in the United States, although there's questions of South Texas, but certainly an issue in our migrant population who become donors. Again, the biggest issue for hearts. Outside of hearts, particularly based on your stratification of the urgency of your recipient, you may be able to get away with these. It's a little less clear. So I hope, having discussed all of these bacteria, viruses, fungi, and things that fall into the broad category of others, In fact, the conclusion is that there's a lot of donors that we can realistically take, provided we go back to those four original sort of key points that I tried to make. Do you know the organism and what are the treatment implications accordingly? Is it systemic or localized, and therefore how many of the potential recipients need to be concerned? Is it something that is really just sort of syndromic, perhaps? And then ultimately also, what's the treatment like under immunosuppression for your recipient? Does the disease become much worse, like West Nile? All of that then gets married with who are your recipient's going to be, and how urgent do they then need this transplant? So with that, thank you.